Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Judges chapter 19. Verses 1 through 30 will cover the story of how an Ephraimite Levite got his concubine murdered. Our context is this. In chapter 18, we see how 600 members of the tribe of Dan move north and capture the city of Laish, later day Caesarea Philippi. And so we begin now in Judges 19, verses 1 through 4. Now it came about in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judea. Now in this story, I'm going to label some people so we can refer to them. They don't have names here, so we're going to call this guy the Ephraimite Levite. And of course, Levites were scattered all throughout the country of Israel. This particular Levite was living in Ephraim, which of course, well, he was living in the hill country of Ephraim, which runs, that's the spine of hills that runs all the way from Manasseh through Ephraim down through Benjamin, right in the middle of the country. So, and his place of living is not stated particularly, so we're just going to call him the Ephraimite Levite. We're going to call the concubine the Ephraimite Levite's concubine. Now, she was from Bethlehem, so maybe we'll call her the concubine from Bethlehem. She had a father living in Bethlehem, so we'll call the father the father-in-law. So, starting with verse 2, but his concubine, the Ephraimite Levite's concubine, played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for a period of 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. They're down in Bethlehem now, 4 or 5 miles south of Jerusalem. His father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Now again, there's that formulaic phrase, there was no king in Israel. Doesn't say that then everyone did what was right in his own eyes, but the idea is there. And of course, it was necessary for the author to put that there as a preface to the gross immorality, which is going to be described in this chapter. The reason that we're going to have a concubine chopped up into 12 pieces, gang raped all night, is because there was no king in Israel to enforce order. Now, the timing of this, again, I'm assuming is before the first judge, Othniel, before the 12 judges begin, when Joshua dies and there's no king in the country. And that word king can be translated as no ruler, no leader, no judge even. There was no law and order. And so, again, that's controverted, but a lot of people think that this happened before the judges actually arose. And these stories are put in the appendix at the end of Judges. Now, I mentioned earlier in verse 1 that the Levite was living in the remote part of the hill country in some unnamed city. It was probably not a Levitical one, not a Levitical city. The Levite was only visiting there, probably sojourning there. The Levite was probably in Ephraim so he could be close to the tabernacle in Shiloh. Shiloh was in Ephraim, the speculation. Now his concubine played the harlot against him in verse 2, unfaithful. That's the NESB translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible has unfaithful to him. Now what does that mean? Well, playing the harlot or being unfaithful could, of course, be taken literally, and it could be that the concubine went out and shacked up with somebody. Well, arguing in favor of this idea is that the Levite seemed very anxious to reconcile himself to his straying concubine. He didn't want to apply the law, which of course was to put an adulterer to death. Now, some people say the law actually forbade him to take her back because of Deuteronomy 24:4, quoted by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Well, first point, how many people paid attention to the law in those days when there was no king? Not many. And a second point, Deuteronomy 24, it's talking about those who have divorced their wives. It's not talking about wives who've run away in harlotry. So I think that's going too far to say the law forced him to take her back. I think that most probably, the most we can say is that the Levite did not try to use the law to get her put to death. He must have still loved the girl. Well, the Holman Christian Study Bible reads that the concubine was unfaithful. The Holman Christian Study Bible margin says that the Septuagint, the Vulgate, read, was angry with. The concubine was angry, not unfaithful to, but was angry with her husband. Perhaps, as Adam Clark puts it, they had contentions. She ceased to love him. Her affections were alienated from him. Well, that puts a little different slant on the story, does it not? She ran because her husband was an SOB. So it's not really clear here why the wife, the concubine, ran, but she did. And because in verse 3, we see that the Ephraimite Levite, her husband, went after her to speak tenderly to her, to bring her back, depending on your view of why she left. Maybe he had heard that she had repented of her sins and wanted to bring her back as a reformed adulteress. Or perhaps, if you take the other view, that she left because she was angry with her Ephraimite Levite husband, perhaps it was only a quarrel and he wanted to make it up. For whatever reason, he heads out to Bethlehem to get her back. Now, when he got down there in verse 3, the girl's father, the concubine's father, and was glad to meet him. So he was not angry with the Ephraimite Levite for treating his daughter badly, even though his daughter had been down there for 4 months and had a good chance, good opportunity to tell her father of all the nasty stuff the Ephraimite Levite had done. Well, why did he show such gladness when the Ephraimite Levite showed up? Well, he could have understood that it was his daughter who was most at fault. Now, if she had indeed committed adultery, and she's down there telling her father what happened, and her father realized that his daughter committed adultery, well, he's not going to take his daughter's side on that point. Besides, at one time, he must have had a high opinion of the Ephraimite Levite because he gave his daughter away in marriage to said Ephraimite Levite. So he's probably wishing for a reconciliation, even as the Ephraimite Levite is wishing for a reconciliation. And here's the opportunity, hot dog. Now, some have speculated, or some have asked the question, well, maybe the Bethlehemite father-in-law should have sent his daughter back up to Ephraim earlier. He should have sought reconciliation, as John Gill says. Well, in my humble opinion, if the girl had committed adultery, I don't think I would have sent her back. The situation might have seemed hopeless. Marriage is broken. Although you do try to get reconciliation even with adultery if you can. But I think that's just speculation, blaming the father. Should he have sent his daughter back earlier? I'd be nervous about sending my daughter to a situation where there was not a happy marriage. After all, he's her father. We go down to Judges 19, verses 5 through 8. Now on the fourth day, they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go. And the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterward you may go." So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry." This is on day 4 now. The first 3 days they've had a good time together, and this is day 4. Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. So that's night 4. On the fifth day, he arose to go early in the morning, trying to go back home with his concubine. And the girl's father said, "Please sustain yourself and wait until afternoon." So both of them ate. Now, this eating on the fourth day with a piece of bread and on the fifth day they ate, is it breakfast or is it midday dinner? John Gill speculates this. He says, apparently, the Ephraimite Levite, the father-in-law, and the concubine didn't just eat breakfast, but they ate a midday dinner also. Jameson Fawcett and Brown said this, quote, "People in the East who take little or nothing to eat in the morning do not breakfast till from 10 to 12 a.m., and this meal the hospitable relative had purposely protracted to so late a period as to afford an argument for urging a further say. So whether it was breakfast or whether it was brunch or whatever it was late, and the father-in-law just postponed it and postponed it. Let's drink, let's eat, let's have a good time, let's let our hearts be merry, so you don't have time to leave." Now, the question I have is, why is the father-in-law so all fired hot to have them stay? Is it because he didn't want to lose the company of his daughter? I wouldn't doubt that. We see the father-in-law, we don't see a mother-in-law, which sounds like she must have passed on already, or for some reason wasn't there. We go down to Judges 19, verses 9 and 10. When the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant, this is on day 5, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold now, the day has drawn to a close. Please spend the night." That would be night 5. "Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow, on day 6, you may arise early for your journey so that you may go home. But the man, this is the Ephraimite Levite, was not willing to spend the night on day five. So he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. And there were with him a pair of saddled donkeys. His concubine also was with him. So on night five, they take out, even though it was late. Why was he not willing just to spend the night and stay another day? He was probably sick and tired of his father-in-law importuning him to stay. To stay, he's got to get back. He's got a job. He's got something he's got to do. He's got to leave. Now you ask, well, why didn't he just spend the night and get up early in the morning and go? He was probably sick to death of it because he wasn't going to go far. They came to a place opposite Jebus. That's Jerusalem. Jebus is the old name for Jerusalem, the old Canaanite name, because that's where the Jebusites lived. And if you look at the map, Bethlehem's about 4 miles south of Jebus. So he's just talking about 4 miles. You can walk 4 miles pretty quick. So even though he started late, he could make it. Now, actually, as we see in the next verse, in verse 12, next couple of verses, he was thinking about going as far as Gibeah, which is just 3 miles even further. So he was talking about 7 miles, depending on whether they stopped in Jerusalem or they kept going to Gibeah, which was 3 miles north of Jerusalem. So that's reasonable. He wanted to get out of Dodge. He was tired of his father-in-law, apparently. So he, his concubine, his servant, and his two donkeys head north to Jerusalem. We go now to Judges 19, verses 11 through 15. When they were near Jebus, that's Jerusalem, the day was almost gone. And the servant said to his master, "Please come and let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." However, his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel, but we will go on as far as Gibeah." He said to his servant, "Come and let us approach one of these places, and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." Now, Ramah's a couple miles north of Gibeah. So they passed along and went their way. And the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. When they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. So let's do some geography here. First of all, they came near Jerusalem, Jebus, and they mentioned that this is a city of foreigners. The Ephraimite Levite tells his servant, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners." Well, how did that happen? Well, it's questionable as to when Judah had captured their part, and it's clear from the scriptures that we're going to read that there were three groups of people that held Jerusalem. There was the people of Judah, there was the tribe of Benjamin, and then there was the pagan Jebusites. It's not clear when the people of Judah had gotten their part. We read in Judges 1:21, "But the sons of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem." So the Jebusites have lived with the sons of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day, because Benjamin was assigned, of course, the northern part of Jerusalem, and they couldn't drive out the Jebusites. So there you got two tribes right there. Benjamin and the Jebusites at the time of the writing of Judges occupied portions of Jerusalem, and then Judah had been allotted Jerusalem. Maybe they had captured it all right and then lost it again. But at any rate, there weren't enough Judahites people there to make this Ephraimite Levite comfortable in staying there. It could be that this story happened before Judah even captured their part. Or maybe they had captured their part of the city and then lost it again. It's not clear. But at any rate, there were foreigners there. And so the Ephraimite from Levite says, "Let's don't stop at Jerusalem. Let's keep going on as far as Gibeah." Now, Gibeah, as I said, is about 3 miles north of Jerusalem. This is according to Easton's dictionary. Gibeah means a hill or a hill town, and it's called Gibeah of Benjamin because there was another place called Gibeah of Judah, and this is a different Gibeah. This is a famous Gibeah, actually, and I'll tell you why, because later on it's known as the Gibeah of Saul. It's famous also because of what we're about to read about in this chapter when the concubine gets gang-raped, and etc. It was also famous because this was where Saul was born. The famous first king of Israel was born here. And after he became king, he continued to live there. It's sometimes called Gibeah of God. And it was a little closer than a place called Ramah, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Verse 13, the Ephraimite Levite tells his servant, "Let's go spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." Why Ramah? Because it was just a few miles north of Gibeah. So let's talk about Ramah. Now, Gibeah is famous, as I said, the birthplace of Saul. And we need to remember it because of what's going to happen here in Judges chapter 19, the rape of the concubine. Ramah's also famous too. Now, this is an absolute rabbit trail. It's just incidentally mentioned in the text. It's not important. But I got curious and started looking at Ramah a little bit. Let's start with Easton's. Jeremiah mentions that he was once a prisoner there among the other captives of Jerusalem when it was taken by Nebuchadnezzar. This is in Jeremiah 40, verse 1, and some verses in Jeremiah 39. This is when the Israelites were captured by the Babylonians and were sent to Ramah as a staging area before they were carried off into exile into Babylon. So it's sort of famous there. And Rachel is said to be weeping for her children in Ramah. In Jeremiah 31, Rachel is pictured as the mother of Israel. And they're all being carried off from Ramah for her because of her slaughtered children. She's crying. And then, of course, I'm leaving Easton's right now. I want to talk about how also in the New Testament, Matthew, in chapter 2, verse 18, says Rachel was crying for her lost children at the slaughter of the infants in Bethlehem when Herod killed all the little kids under 2 years old. Well, that's an interesting thing because Rachel buried at Ramah crying for her children happened once. Well, she died once, buried somewhere, and then that's used as a reason to say that she's crying for her children when the Israelites were carried off into exile in Babylon. Well, what makes this thing so hard is that some people say that Rachel was buried, the scripture says she was buried on the way to Bethlehem. So some people say somewhere to the north of Bethlehem, near Bethlehem, she was buried. But other people say, no, there's only this Ramah that's 4 or 5 miles north of Jerusalem. 5 miles north of Jerusalem, as Easton says. That's only this one. There is no Ramah down there in Bethlehem. And so when Matthew says that Rachel is crying for the loss of her sons, you don't really point to Ramah is the place where the crying is done because Bethlehem is about 10 miles. Ramah is north of Jerusalem 5 miles and Benjamin south of Jerusalem 5 miles. So the Ramah, the place name, doesn't fit exactly. Now you could, if you say that there's a Ramah in Bethlehem, right near Bethlehem, then the reference that Matthew makes to the slaughter of the innocents and Rachel crying for her children would fit geographically. But then what about the staging area to Babylon? I guess you could say they were staged there south of Jerusalem, right north of Bethlehem, on their way to Babylon. That might work. But the problem is people don't know that there is a place in the south called Ramah. And some people say there's one in the south and south of Jerusalem and one to the north of Jerusalem. So it gets extremely confusing. So let me just read you several quotes from some sources. Here's one from Wikipedia. Quote, biblical scholarship identifies two different traditions in the Hebrew Bible concerning the site of Rachel's burial. Respectively, a northern version, locating it north of Jerusalem near Ramah, modern Al-Ram, and a southern narrative, locating it close to Bethlehem. So there's your dispute right there. Now, the Cambridge commentary says this, Cambridge Bible for Schools, commentary for schools and colleges, quote, the Ramah alluded to by Jeremiah, generally identified with the modern Ramah, was about 5 miles north of Jerusalem. That's the one where the Ephraimite Levite is thinking about perhaps going. And it's in the tribe of Benjamin, Cambridge continues. There is no proof of another Ramah near Bethlehem. So there's an argument for northern Ramah, no southern Ramah. Wikipedia says there's an argument for two Ramahs. Ellicott says there's two Ramahs. Third quote, this is again from Cambridge. The geographical connection of Ramah and Bethlehem cannot be maintained. It depends upon a statement which is probably a gloss in Genesis 35:19, Genesis 48:7, which is too technical to go into here. But the point is that connection, that Cambridge commentary just flatly denies that there's any southern Ramah. Cambridge commentary also says in another place, quote, Ramah is mentioned first in Joshua 18:25 between Gibeon and Beeroth, 5 miles north of Jerusalem, and is very possibly identical with the birthplace, home, and place of burial of Samuel. That's another reason we need to, the northern Ramah, we do know it was Samuel's birthplace and death site of his death. Cambridge continues, it was much too far, this northern Ramah, was much too far from Bethlehem to be in any way immediately connected with the subject and illustration of which St. Matthew quotes the passage, the slaughter of the innocents, too far away. Now, this northern Ramah, says Cambridge, was the place that the exiles were assembled for departing from Babylon, as described in Jeremiah 40, verse 1. Well, if you take Cambridge's position on it, Matthew 2:18 has got to be explained this way, and I'm going to try to do it right now. Matthew 2:18 reads like this, "A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be consoled because they were no more." Now Matthew is quoting Jeremiah, of course, and the problem when you read Matthew 2:18 is this phrase, "A voice was heard in Ramah." If there's no place where Rachel was buried in Bethlehem, then how can there be a voice in Ramah, which is north of Jerusalem, not south of Jerusalem, near Bethlehem? Well, I think the point is that Matthew was quoting Jeremiah just to show that there was weeping. Rachel was being weeping over his children, not the exact place where she was weeping. It was in Bethlehem, but he's quoting Jeremiah, and Jeremiah was quoting the weeping as being done in Ramah, which is where the exiles were being assembled for export to Babylon. So the point of the analogy that Matthew is making is the children of Israel were being wept over by Rachel, not exactly where she was buried. That's an interesting question. It's unfortunately over my head, or I haven't taken the time and don't have the time to go into it in much, much deeper detail. If you like to get into the weeds, that'd be something interesting to study. But that is a rabbit trail. That has nothing to do with our story. So let's turn back and see what the protagonists in our story are going to do here. The Ephraimite, Levite, his concubine, and the servant. Verse 14, Judges 19, "They passed along and went their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Gibeon. They turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. When they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into the house to spend the night." Now, it's quite understandable that no one took them into the house, given what we're going to see. A bunch of rowdy, a bunch of homosexual perverts are going to come in and threaten bodily harm to the Ephraimite, Levite, and so if that's the kind of stuff that was going on at night, they had no police forces back then. It was understandable nobody would take them in because the Ephraimite, Levite might have been a bad guy, just like the bad guys who later show up. So they're kind of in a bad spot. The sun's gone down. They're in the square. They have no place, no hotel to go to, no inn. And so they sat down. And John Gill says they sat down, quote, "to see whether any person would invite him in into any of their houses, as was usual in those hospitable times and countries, and where there were few inns for the entertainment of travelers and strangers, or none at all, and especially in cities, if any, where they were upon the public road." They weren't on the public road now, they were in the city. Now, Eastern hospitality was a big deal back then, so I assume the Ephraimite Levite was counting on that, hopefully. Jameson Fawcett Brown said, quote, "We conclude that the custom, which is still frequently witnessed in the cities of the East, was then not uncommon for travelers who were late in arriving and who had no introduction to a private family to spread their bedding in the streets or wrapping themselves up in their cloaks, pass the night in the open air. In the Arab towns and villages, however, the sheikh or some other person usually comes out and urgently invites the strangers to his house. This was done also in ancient Palestine. That the same hospitality was not shown in Gibeah seems to have been owing to the bad character of the people." So, the Ephraimite Levite assumed he was going to get somebody to ask him into his house, and it didn't happen, at least not at first. We go now to Judges 19, verses 16 through 20. "In the evening, an old man came in from his work in the field." Again, this is getting on toward sundown. It's getting late. "He was from the hill country of Ephraim, but was residing in Gibeah. And the men of that place were Benjamites." Now remember, the hill country of Ephraim, it doesn't just mean the mountains in Ephraim. It means the mountains going all the way up around the Sea of Galilee and Manasseh, south through Ephraim, south through Benjamin, that spine of that ridge of hills running up like a spine up the middle of Israel. So that's where he was from, same place the Ephraimite Levite was from. "But the old man was residing in Gibeah. When he looked up and saw the traveler in the city square, the old man asked, 'Where are you going, and where did you come from?' He answered him, 'We are traveling from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote hill country of Ephraim, where I am from. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I'm going to the house of the Lord.'" That would be in Shiloh, which is in Ephraim. "No one has taken me into his home, although we have both straw and feed for our donkeys and bread and wine for me, your female servant, and the young man with your servant." That's a little confusing. I'll explain that in a minute. "There is nothing we lack." "Peace to you," said the old man. "I'll take care of everything you need. Only don't spend the night in the square." First of all, translation problems. The Ephraimite Levite said he's going back to the house of the Lord in verse 18. Some translations say, I'm going back to my house. In fact, the NASB has my house. The KJV and the NIV and the Holman Christian Study Bible say the house of the Lord. Well, if he's going back to my house, there's no problem there. If he's going back to the house of the Lord, you might ask why. He's probably referring to the tabernacle at Shiloh, which, of course, is in Ephraim, perhaps to offer a thanksgiving sacrifice, thankful for the return of his wife. Interesting speculation. And, of course, now when he says, hey, nobody's taking me into his home, he's probably expressing surprise to the old man. I thought somebody would have taken me in by now. And now to urge the old man to take him in, or at least to point out his plight to show that he's not being a burden on any potential host, he says, I've got straw for the donkeys, so any potential host would not have to feed my donkeys. I've got bread and wine for me. They don't even have to feed me. I've got bread and wine for me and your female servant. Now, this is an artifact of the customs back then. When you wanted to be humble, you would the people who are speaking would call themselves servants of the people they're speaking to. So when he says your female servant, he's talking about your old man, female servant, my concubine. So he's got enough bread and wine for his concubine and the young man with your servant. Your servant, again, is the Ephraimite Levite, and the young man with the Ephraimite Levite is the slave or the servant that he had brought down from Ephraim to Bethlehem. So basically he's saying, hey, we got everything we need, but nobody will take us in. Now, the Ephraimite Levite said he had straw for his donkeys. Adam Clark says this, quote, there was no hay, but as they raised some corn, they took great care of their straw, chopped it very small, and having mixed it with barley, beans, or the pounded kernels of dates, made it into balls and fed their cattle with it. I guess that's the answer to the question, is why would they be carrying it around as food? Carrying straw around for a donkey to sleep in seems sort of strange, and I don't think that's what's meant here. Verse 20, peace to you, said the old man. I'll take care of everything you need, only don't spend the night in the square. You know, it's bad enough for anybody to spend the night in an open square, but it's even worse for a Levite. He's possibly going up to sacrifice at Shiloh. So this Ephraimite Levite had some status. We go now to verses 21 through 24 of Judges 19. So he, that's the old man, took him into his house, took the Ephraimite Levite into the old man's house, and gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet. That would be the feet of the Ephraimite Levite, the feet of his concubine, and the feet of his servant. And they ate and drank. While they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have relations with him. And folks, that's not diplomatic relations. They are talking about sexual relations. Verse 23, then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine, and you thought chivalry was dead. I mean, the old man not only offered his own virgin daughter, she's new to the piece here, but also his guest concubine. Well, that was real nice of him. He didn't even ask permission, just said, here, you take her concubine. Take his concubine. The concubine that he has spent so much trouble trying to get out of Bethlehem back to Ephraim. Please, the old man continues, please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish. But do not commit such an act of folly against this man. Now, these worthless fellows that showed up, they're obviously pretty worthless, all right, as we'll see. But this is what Adam Clark says, quote, these were genuine sodomites as to their practice. Sons of Belial, that's the devil, rascals and miscreants of the deepest dye, worse than brutes, being a compound of beast and devil inseparably blended. Whew, that sounds like some politicians I know. But they weren't the only worthless fellows in this story. As Adam Clark continues to point out, quote, the men of Gibeah who wished to abuse the body of the Levite, yeah, they were worthless. The Levite who wished to save his body at the expense of the modesty, reputation, and life of his wife, that's the Ephraimite Levite, he was a worthless fellow. And the old man who wished to save his guest at the expense of the violation of his daughter are all characters that humanity and modesty wish to be buried in everlasting oblivion. Ooh, again, sounds like some politicians I know. Now, these worthless fellows are pounding on the doors of the old man. There's two reasons why they might have been doing that. One, they could just wanted to get the old man to open the door, or maybe they were pounding it so as to break it down and to execute force of entry, perhaps. But at any rate, it was not just a gentle rap, tap, tap, knock on the door. It was they were pounding on the door. Now, this is a cultural thing. In the East, hospitality was almost a religious duty. So when in verse 23, he says, don't do this. This man is coming to my house. Do not do this act of folly. This man, do not act wickedly. This man is coming to my house. You think, well, what's the big deal coming into my house? It's because he owes him hospitality, the old man does. And so the old man is appealing to that Oriental law of hospitality. Now, the old man had no right to prostitute his daughter. He had no right to prostitute the concubine of his guest. He apparently was reacting out of surprise and terror. John Gill suggests he was perhaps acting in imitation of Lot. Remember when Lot was entertaining angels in the form of men, and the homosexuals, the Sodomites of Sodom, knocked on the door and says, we won't have relations with these men. And Lot says, hey, I got some daughters you can have. Boy, I tell you, chivalry. I appreciate it more and more the more I read some of these Old Testament stories. Now, in verse 23, the old man says, do not do this act of folly. The act of folly turned out to be homosexual rape, gang rape. Well, actually, the act of folly that he was contemplating was not gang rape of the concubine, but was homosexual rape of the Ephraimite Levite. And also, that homosexual rape was perhaps going to be followed by murder. In Judges 20, verse 5, which is in our next chapter, the Ephraimite Levite is explaining what happened. He says, but the men of Gibeah rose up against me, the Ephraimite Levite, and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me. Instead, they ravished my concubine. So, I don't know whether the worthless fellows actually intended to kill the Ephraimite Levite, but the Ephraimite Levite definitely thought they wanted to kill him. But whether that's true or not, there's no question that they were planning to homosexually rape the Ephraimite Levite because they said so. They said, bring out the man that we may have relations with him. Yes, sir. Now, Adam Clark's got a great quote here. He says, quote, I have passed over the abominable transactions of this chapter as lightly as I could and shall make no apology to the learned or unlearned reader for leaving some things untranslated. That reminds me, there's a famous Chinese novel called Jinping Mei. It's been banned in China for years because the communists want to protect the virgin purity of the Chinese public. But it was an ancient Chinese classic, and I ran into an English translation of it in my college library here in the States. And I said, well, that's interesting. So I sat down and read the novel. It was extremely interesting. It was very long. And it had a lot of old ancient Chinese culture in it, and I thought it was great. But when they got to the dirty parts, the English translator would just translate into Latin, figuring that the average person couldn't read it. Well, I couldn't read it. But right on the same floor where my office was, there was a retired Jesuit priest who was a visiting professor. And so I thought, I bet he knows Latin. So I took that book to him, I said, and explained to him what it was. I said, could you translate to Latin? He says, okay, because I challenged him. You know, he wanted to use his Latin. So he sat down there, and he started translating that thing, and all of a sudden he goes, oh, my gosh. And he just stopped dead, and he didn't continue to translate. Well, apparently Adam Clark says there's something in this chapter that he doesn't want to translate. I don't know what that is. I mean, everything seems translated to me. I don't know how you hide the evil of what's going on in this chapter. We go now to Judges 19, verses 25 through 27. But the men would not listen. That's the worthless fellows, the homosexuals, perverts, rapists. They would not listen to him, would not listen to the old man who would offer them women instead of men. So the man seized his concubine. The man is the Ephraimite Levite, seized his concubine and brought her out to them. And that apparently mollified the worthless fellow. So the Ephraimite Levite saved himself from homosexual rape, but at what cost? He takes his concubine out to the worthless fellows, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning. This is a gang rape, folks, and gang rapes aren't over quickly, all night long. Then let her go at the approach of dawn. As the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house, the old man's house, where her master was, that's the Ephraimite Levite, until full daylight. And so she lay there for a while as the sun rose. Verse 27, when her master, the Ephraimite Levite, arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. Now in verse 25, we read the worthless fellows would not listen to the old man offering his daughter, but they did listen to the Ephraimite Levite when the Ephraimite Levite gave them his concubine. So that has given risen to speculation that the concubine was beautiful and the old man's daughter was not, because the homosexual rapist would not, or they, I really should say they were bisexual, they would not listen, they would not take the old man's daughter. I don't know if that's reasonable to think that or not. It could be that the Ephraimite Levite just interrupted the whole process here and says, look, take my concubine. You don't have to argue anymore. You don't have to steal. You don't have to snatch. Here she is. Might not have had a thing to do with how beautiful the old man's daughter was or not beautiful. Now, the Ephraimite Levite brought his concubine to the homosexual perverts. Now, that bringing, was it with the concubine's consent or was it without her consent? Well, if it was with her consent and she volunteered herself in order to save the honor of her husband, well, that's pretty heroic. But quite frankly, I don't think she was volunteering for duty here. Here's what Adam Clark says, quote, "The word Yahazek, which we here translate simply took or brought, signifies rather to take or seize by violence. The woman would not go out to them, but her graceless husband forced her to go in order that he might save his own body. He could have but little love for her, and this was the cause of their separation before." I think Clark actually speculating pretty good there. He probably said, "Here, come here, concubine. You're going out there whether you want to or not," because he was a jerk. Now, the concubine, well, not the concubine, but the author of the text here refers to the concubine's husband as her master. Well, that's some master, all right? A master is supposed to take care of those over whom he has charge. This is some master, some lord, I tell you. And verse 27, the Ephraimite Levite gets up to leave. It was probably early in the morning because he wanted to get out of there, to get out of Dodge, and it was quiet outside because the gang rape was over. He went out to go on his way. Now, do you think that he was going to try to find his concubine as he opened the door, or he just flat given up on her? I suspect the latter. I think he says, she's dead, she's gone, she's been raped, she's been abducted, she's been kidnapped, I'm going back home. I used to have sympathy for this guy. I don't have any sympathy for him anymore. He opens the door, and verse 27, he sees his concubine lying at the threshold. Now, why was she lying there? Well, she was probably too weak to stand and knock at the door. The KJV has she was falling down at the door of the house, not lying, but falling down, which sounds like she staggered there and collapsed. Adam Clark says she had strength to reach the door, but not to knock for admittance. When she reached the door, she fell down dead. Or another option, she might have been lying there because she just wanted to rest until someone opened the door in the morning. I don't think so. I think she was trying to get back in and just didn't make it. It was pretty tragic, pretty awful. Now, she's lying at the doorway. More specifically, it says she's lying at the doorway with her hands on the threshold as she reached forward, put her hands on the threshold. At least that's one option, one way you could read it. Her hands were stretched out, clawing as if to save herself. Another way you could read it is she had her hands under her head so she could sleep, kind of on her side, had her hands stuck under her head. I know, the story's much better. She's clawing her way to try to get to safety, and she dies trying to do it. And I suspect not only does that make a better story, but that's actually what happened. We go now to Judges 19, verses 28 through 30, and we will continue with the concubine's fate and finish this audio. He, that's the Ephraimite Levite, said to her, his concubine, lying at the threshold, "Get up and let us go." But there was no answer. Then he placed her on the donkey. There was no answer because she was dead. Then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. When he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. All who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up." Now the concubine gave the Levite, the Ephraimite Levite, no answer when he saw her there because she was dead. Through grief, shame, physical injury, and the cold of the night. She had no clothes to cover her, by the way. And it gets cold. I don't know what time of the year this was, but even if it's summertime, it gets cold at night in those desert climates. Now, when he saw his concubine dead, instead of going out to look for these worthless fellows and try to get some justice on them, he didn't do that. Well, he's outnumbered. He's in a strange place. It's not his home. His enemies are amongst their fellow Benjamites. No point in seeking justice, so he just goes home. Now, if the earlier translation that he was trying to return to Shiloh, return to the house of the Lord instead of to his house, if that be the case, then that intention to go to Shiloh to offer sacrifice, that's over. He's going home to seek justice, and we'll see why. Just as a preview, he's going to cut up his concubine in 12 pieces, put them on donkeys, send the donkeys to the 12 tribes of Israel, saying, hey, I need some justice here, my fellow Israelites. Now, cutting up his concubine, he didn't do that to show disrespect to his wife, which, in my opinion, it did, but that wasn't his motive. His motive was to express his vehement passion about what had happened. One of my commentators says, quote, it is very likely that they considered each of the pieces as expressing an execration. If ye will not come and avenge my wrongs, may you be hewn in pieces like this abused and murdered woman. Now, when everybody who saw the chopped up woman, and no doubt the chopped up woman was accompanied by the words of the messenger who carried the donkey with the chopped up woman to the 12 tribes, when they saw that, they said, nothing like this has ever happened before in Israel. This deed indeed became very famous in Israel. It was mentioned by the prophet Hosea hundreds of years later, Hosea 9:9, they have gone deep in depravity as in the days of Gibeah. The days of Gibeah. Gibeah is just referred to as a shorthand for this whole story of the chopped up concubine. And those that Hosea was prophesying against will remember, God will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. Now, why did the Ephraimite Levite chop his concubine into 12 pieces? There's a couple of options on how you can count the tribes to whom the pieces were delivered. Option number one calculates in such a way that he would send a piece to the Benjamites, the people who did all this evil stuff. And then there's another way to count the 12 where he would leave Benjamin out. Let's start with the first option, that there was a piece sent to Benjamin. Well, there's 12 original tribes, but you remember the Levites didn't have any tribal division, so that knocked it down to 11. But Manasseh had two half-tribes, one on the west and one on the east of the Jordan River, so that knocks it back up to 12. And then that 12 would include the original tribe of Benjamin. I don't think that's reasonable. I think that the way to count is this. You got the original 12. You take Joseph out because his two sons were substituted. So taking Joseph out gives 11. You add his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, back in. That gives 13. Now, the Levites don't have a tribal division. That knocks you back down to 12. Now, Manasseh has two halves, east and west Manasseh. That gives you 13. And then you don't give the Benjamites a piece because they're the enemy. Subtract 1 from 13, and that gives you 12. I think that's what happened. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with the macabre events of chapter 19 of Judges. We are now ready in our next audio to go to Judges chapter 20, and we will see that this unfortunate incident led to a war, a civil war in Israel that almost wiped the tribe of Benjamin out. We are actually going to have to probably take two audios to do that. It's a long chapter 20. I'll try to cover the first 25 verses of chapter 20 in our next audio, which I hope you stay tuned for, and I hope you enjoyed this one.